Yeah, I love it. Thanks, Bill. Thanks, guys. All right. For health and strength and daily food, we praise thy name, O Lord. Amen. That was my prayer growing up as a kid around the dinner table. Mom, why didn't you kick in on harmony there? That would have been really nice. I grew up, and how many of you have had like a childhood thing around the table where you had some sort of song that you sang or some normal sort of thing, right? That was my song. I don't know why we stopped doing it if my sister and I just got to the point where we didn't want to sing anymore, but eventually my dad took over praying. And he would pray these really long prayers. And my sister and I, from that short little song to that, we just kind of opened one eye at one another and be like, is he done yet? Maybe if I squeeze his hand, he'll be done sooner. But we slowly transitioned from the short little song into the long prayers my father made. And now my children probably think that I pray the same long prayers. It's funny, and you just become your parents eventually. The dinner table is sacred space if we have the eyes to see it. This is what Will Willimon says. He's a bishop in the United Methodist Church. This is what he says about the dinner table and about the sacredness of it. Think about just everything that goes into the food that we eat. Every dinner table is a scene of service and sacrifice if God gives us the grace to see it. We eat only because of the service of others. When, at table, I pick up a slice of bread, the staff of life, I do so as a debtor. People whose names I'll never know tilled the soil, sowed the seed, patiently waited until the time was right, harvested the wheat, milled the flour, kneaded the dough, baked the loaf, delivered the bread, shelved it, sold it, toasted it, and presented it at the table. There's a lot that goes into that. The grace to see that Will Willimon talks about here is at the heart of communion. This is a cute little glass of water. Thanks, Nicole. Asked her for a glass of water. We'll just a little sippy sippy. All right. On the front of your bulletin this morning, if you were looking where communion is, there's another word that is there for communion. And part of seeing the heart of communion is understanding this word Eucharist. Understanding this word Eucharist. Eucharist is actually the most common word used throughout all denominations of churches, all Christians throughout the world. Eucharist is the most common word that is used for what we call communion. The Greek word for Eucharist is Eucharisteo. It means thanksgiving. The root word, so if you get some behind the meaning of the meaning, the root word, the Greek root word is charis, and that means grace. And the derivative of charis is chara, which means joy. And so Eucharist is a grace-filled, joyful thanksgiving. So we could say communion is a grace-filled, joyful thanksgiving. And we need this meal, this Eucharist, to see what God is up to in the world. We need this meal to help us to see this grace that is at the table. Will Willimon talks about this grace to see, and we need Eucharist, we need communion, we need thanksgiving in order to see things in the proper way. If you have Bibles this morning, turn with me to John chapter 6. We're going to read verses 1 through 15 together. It'll be on the screen behind me, but if you want to use your own Bible, that's great too. It's a familiar story to all of us, and it's another meal story. So this meal doesn't necessarily take place around a table, but it's nonetheless a meal. And so throughout the series on communion, we're wanting to develop a deeper understanding about why we do communion, why we do what we do, because there is so many different layers of meaning. And it's not just about the Last Supper that we think is the communion meal. That meal is a culmination of all the meals that Jesus has had with people or with other people before the Last Supper. And so what we're doing in these first couple of weeks is we're looking at meals that Jesus had with other people to help understand what that final meal, that communion meal, means and signifies. So here we go from verses 1 through 15, John chapter 6. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming towards him, he said to Philip, "Where should we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Well, here's a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish. But how far is that going to go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to the disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who has come into the world." Now Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountainside by himself. Some background on this passage, and most of this background is actually chalked into verse 4, which really just gives us a sense of association. So verse 4 says this: the Jewish Passover feast was near. So when these kinds of mentions are made, it's for the intentions, for the intention of the synapses of our brain to fire and make some connections. So when the Jewish Passover feast, it says the Jewish Passover feast is near, John is wanting us to realize the connection that what Jesus is doing here is connected with the Jewish Passover. Now, Passover, if you're not familiar, Passover is this Old Testament salvation experience where God delivers Israel from the Egyptian oppressors. Now, being at the time of Passover, this is also significant in verse 15, because they are looking for, the Jews of that time are looking for someone to again deliver them from the oppressors that are in front of them currently, and those oppressors would have been Rome. And so in verse 15, Jesus withdraws because they have different motivations of how to use him. They think, okay, God is going to do the same thing for us that he did before with the Exodus and with defeating the Egyptians. And he's going to do this with the Messiah. And perhaps this is the Messiah who's going to overthrow our Roman oppressors. And so they seek to make him king by force. Jesus wants no part of that. That's not his way. That's not his methodology. And so he withdraws again by himself. So it's not only the time that is coincidental, but it's also the activity and what's going on in this passage that reminds us of the Passover. So if you have your Bibles and you want to flip, you can, to Exodus chapter 16. I'm just going to read verses 3 and 4. So the context of this passage is they have crossed the Red Sea. They're away and free from their Egyptian oppressors now. They've crossed the Red Sea, but they have little to no resources. They don't have a way to sustain themselves. They don't have a way to continually feed themselves. And so it's in this place that they begin to grumble against Moses and Aaron. So verse 3 and 4 in chapter 16 of Exodus. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food that we wanted. But you have brought us out into the desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them and see whether or not they will follow my instructions." So there's a lot of similarities of what's happening in these two passages. God delivers in the Exodus through Moses, the deliverer. God is delivering in this passage, although the people don't know it and they don't know how he's going to do it yet. But God is going to deliver the people through Jesus in this passage. Both passages have huge, hungry crowds. In both passages, God feeds them. And in both passages, there's a reference to a test. So in the book of Exodus, we just read that he does this in order to test them, to test their faith. And in this same passage, he asks Philip and Peter to, he knows what he's going to do, but he asks them in order to test them. I want to talk about a test for just a few moments, because sometimes we think of a test in a negative form. We think God is testing us. But if you think, even just from an educational perspective, I've not been a teacher. I've never administered a test, but I've taken plenty of tests. How many of you would be fine if you never took another test in your life? Probably. So I've taken a lot of tests. Well, tests are predicated on having some sort of knowledge, right? A test is an opportunity for us to display or present the knowledge that we have learned. Okay, so we have a test, we have knowledge, but we have knowledge because we've learned something. We've learned something because we've been taught something. And so oftentimes we disconnect it and we just think of it as a test, but a test is really an opportunity to put into practice that's which we have been taught by Jesus. And so in both the Exodus passage and in the John passage, teaching has happened through the miraculous hand of God. In the Exodus passage, God shows himself through the plagues. He shows himself through the parting of the Red Sea. And this passage that we read in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 16 doesn't come very far after. And so all these things, the people have just walked through on dry ground with probably some mountainous waters on both sides of them. And they're like, now what are we going to eat? And in the John passage, what has happened is, in the previous chapters, Jesus has done miracles in front of the disciples. These things are teaching tools. He's trying to show them who he is. And so this is an opportunity for them to step out and say, okay, well, this is what Jesus has been doing. This is what Jesus has been telling us. And now Jesus wants to find faith. He wants his disciples to put into practice what he has been showing them and teaching them. I really like what Frederick Bruner said in his commentary on the book of John in this passage. He says, from the very beginning of this feeding story, we learn afresh that Jesus loves to find faith in his disciples. Like sometimes we think tests are set up in order to prove what we don't know. But I love Bruner's take on it, that Jesus wants to see his kids, his disciples, grab on to this faith. He wants to see it. And it's almost like Jesus is saying, okay, boys, now it's your turn. Here's the opportunity. This is the test of faith. So how do Philip and Andrew respond? We had read this before, but Philip is incredibly practical. Okay, so for all you practical people out there, Philip responds in a very practical way, and he has every right to do so. He's from the area, so he knows what restaurants are out there, and he knows that there aren't any. Right? He knows that there are no resources out there to feed this amount of people. And even if there were, they didn't have enough money to buy all the resources that were necessary to feed all of these people. And it's not 5,000, it's at least double that number, because women and children are not mentioned here at all. And so, from a practical perspective, he just says, we don't have enough. There isn't enough here. Andrew's a little better. One of the interesting things about Andrew in the Gospels is that each time you read about Andrew, he's bringing somebody to Jesus. So if you remember in our last series, Come and Follow Me, he brings his brother Peter to meet Jesus. And so each time we encounter Andrew, he's bringing somebody to Jesus. And so this extroverted disciple has probably been milling about these 5,000 people, and he knows that this boy is out there, and he brings him to Jesus, and he says, this is what we have. Obviously not enough, but this is what we have. And so this is their response. Practicality, a little bit of faith, this is what we've got. But the point of the passage isn't the feeding part. It's not the feeding part. The hinge of the passage is in verse 11. And if you go to verse 11, it'll be on the screen behind me. It says this, Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When Jesus breaks the bread and gives thanks, this small giving thanks, I think, is really the crux of the passage. It is when he gives thanks that in some ways their eyes are broken open to be able to see the possibilities of what is possible when God is with us. That word there, the Greek word for give thanks in this passage for Jesus is eucharisteo. It's thanksgiving. It's grace. It's joy. This is not the only place where this word is used in the New Testament. It's not always around mealtimes either. At the mealtime of the Last Supper, it's the same thing. Jesus takes the bread, breaks it, gives thanks, gives it to his disciples. This happens at the Last Supper. Giving thanks, Jesus giving thanks, happens before the resurrection of Lazarus. In the last chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus breaking bread and giving thanks is what opens the eyes of the two disciples that were with him on the road to Emmaus. And it is in that moment when Jesus gives thanks that their eyes are open to who they've been with throughout the whole day. Eucharist, thanksgiving, communion opens our eyes. It opens our eyes. It's a new way for disciples to see things. Before, Philip and Andrew see things with human eyes. They see the overwhelming need. They see the lack of resources. But why does Thanksgiving change everything? Why does it change everything? Here's my working definition. This is nobody's definition but my own. Here's my working definition of Thanksgiving or of Eucharist. Is realizing that there is no place where the presence of God is not. And then receiving the presence of God in the place where you are. So it's all about a recognition and a connection with the presence of God. And the power of what Jesus is doing when he gives thanks is he is announcing and proclaiming that in this present moment, God is here. In the Exodus, with the feeding, with the bread coming in that moment, it is an announcement that God has not abandoned them. God is there. As the disciples are in the midst of thousands and thousands of hungry people, Jesus gives thanks and in doing so announces God is here. At the Last Supper, on the night that he was betrayed, and he knew what was ahead of him in the cross, Jesus gives thanks and says, even in that place, God is here. At the death of Lazarus, where there is no hope whatsoever, Jesus gives thanks and says, God is here. And Lazarus is raised from the dead. Thanksgiving is us living with the sight that says, God is here. God is here. And in Eucharist, or in communion, what we're doing is acknowledging and inviting and celebrating the presence of Christ in this present moment. God's people are a Eucharist people. We are a people of communion and thanksgiving. And this is why I think having communion every time you gather for worship is so powerful and so important. It opens our eyes again to the presence of God among us. Rowan Williams puts it this way, we are those who can see humanity and the whole material world in a fresh way. Seeing people and things sacramentally or sacredly. Seeing the depth within them, where the giving of God is always at work. And so while Andrew and Philip originally pre-Thanksgiving, pre-Eucharist, pre-communion might just see things as they are around them, Thanksgiving, communion, and Eucharist is a way for us to be able to see the depth of things around us because God is among and in and through those things and he is at work in those things. Oftentimes we think of Thanksgiving as, well, I'm thankful for this or I'm thankful for that. We need to have something tangible to be thankful for. But here's the issue, is if that never translates to actually being thankful to the source of the things that you're thankful for, it's simply consumerism. Because it's all about how these things that we're thankful for benefit us, and that's why we're thankful for them, because we're receiving them. And so if we don't ever connect that which what we're thankful for, if we don't ever connect that with God, who is the source of all those things, it simply becomes something that is self-satisfactory. It's simply consumerism. And we can use thanksgiving language in a very spiritual way, but if we never move past the thing that we're thankful for to allowing that to connect us to God in a deeper way, then it simply becomes about us. It simply becomes about us. It needs to be more than simply the external things that you and I are thankful for. And thanksgiving is bigger than having something to be thankful for in the first place because, frankly, sometimes it's really hard to have anything to be thankful for. If thanksgiving is measured on being able to have that, be able to give thanks for something, sometimes life is so hard, sometimes life is overwhelming. Sometimes you don't feel like giving thanks for that which is around you. And I think sometimes the dangerous teaching or thought that even comes around in Christian circles is, you know, you need to be thankful for everything. You need to be thankful for all things. And I don't think that's the case. Because not everything... Is thankful worthy. It's kind of a twisting of scriptures because we're supposed to be thankful in all things, in, not for. Big difference. And so it is not dependent. Our external circumstances we're not dependent on our external circumstances to be able to give thanks for something. We don't have to give thanks for everything. But in Eucharist and in communion, it is in all things we give thanks. In the midst of this, what we're doing is we're saying, wherever we are, good, bad, or ugly, in thanksgiving and in giving God thanks, we are acknowledging that God is with us in the present moment. We're saying that we are not alone, that we've not been abandoned by God. It's an announcement of the presence of God in the midst of wherever we are. That is thanksgiving. That is Eucharist. Thanksgiving or Eucharist for each one of us is the breaking of that bread, of this bread, as we come to this table and saying, no matter how I come to this table, no matter where I'm at in my life, just like we talked about last week, sometimes we're the Pharisee, sometimes we're the woman, sometimes we're in between. It doesn't matter because the table doesn't change. The invitation to us doesn't change. This invitation is for us to be able to give thanks because at this table and in communion or Eucharist, God is present with us. It is a weekly and consistent reminder that we have not been abandoned. We're not alone. It doesn't take much faith. And that's all that Jesus is looking for, is a tiny bit. And maybe some weeks it's all you can do to crawl up here. But when you do, it is an act of faith that says, God is with me now. It is a declaration that says, God is with me now. And I can see my life in a different way as I see it with God, with me now. Life is kind of hopeless if we don't see it through the eyes of faith. We will get really, really weary and we will want to give up if we do not see this through the eyes of faith, if we do not see our lives through the eyes of faith. Eucharist and communion with God is this invitation for you and for me to say that God is with me, is with you now, where you are. As we prepare for communion this morning, I'd just like to give us a few minutes of silence. If you want to close your eyes, you may do that. In a time of prayer, meditation, you may do that. But here's what I would like and just encourage you in your preparation for communion this morning. Is just in your own way, quietly, just to be able to say, God, this is where I am. Be honest about it. Be honest about it. Good, bad, or ugly. Just, God, this is where I am.